Hey, you're listening to World Cafe. I'm Talia Schlanger. Today, music from a debut album that's been 50 years in the making. My guests are Ace of Cups.
Do you know, baby, I ain't hard to reach at all.
Ace of Cups came together in San Francisco in the late 60s. They played some amazing venues, opened up for Jimi Hendrix, and they were trailblazers. When Ace of Cups first started playing together, there were bands fronted by women, but
we'd never seen an all-women band. So we had no one to look to. It just came organically from our connection.
Things didn't exactly work out for Ace of Cups back then, but they didn't give up. Last year, they put out their debut studio album, and they're here to perform songs from it. They also share stories from the summer of love, including introducing Paul Simon to the Grateful Dead and stories about their lives since the 60s. We've got original members Denise, Mary Ellen, Mary Gannon, Diane, and touring keyboard player Giovanna in studio. They started us off with the song Feel Good from their debut studio album. It's Ace of Cups.
I really like it 'cause it makes me feel so good.
Does it feel good, baby? Baby, how does it feel? live here at World Cafe, Ace of Cups. That song appears on their debut full-length album as a band. Ladies, we are so excited to have you here. Welcome to the World Cafe.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, I'd love for you to each introduce yourselves and let us know what you played. And maybe we'll start with Diane, who just ripped the craziest drum solo in the middle of that song.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I just let it all out, you know. Sometimes, and I don't know what's going to come out. That's the beauty of it sometimes.
Great.
But thank you that, you know, you expressed that.
Absolutely. So we've got Diane on drums. We've got Mary G on
Ukulele, sometimes bass on Waller Street, and Shaker and Eggs.
Fantastic. We got Denise.
Hi, I play mostly bass, some harmonica, and... I just want to say about Mary G that what she brings is a spirit and an energy, and that whatever she's doing, it makes the band.
Oh, thank you.
Ditto from me, Mary Ellen.
Yeah.
And so I play guitar. I have a very beautiful green Strat that I just love. The color and I've always loved Strats. So that's my deal.
Nice. So we're gonna hear you play. I understand the first song that you wrote together, and maybe it's called Waller Street Blues. Let's use that as a way for you to take us to that point in your lives when you all first met each other. So before we hear Waller Street Blues, I mean, tell us about Waller Street.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was my apartment first when I had gotten back from a trek in Alaska with my college friend. And then I rented a piano, $14 a month. The rent was $75 a month.
This is like 1960?
66.
Okay.
And
in San Francisco.
It was just parallel to Haight Street, on the corner of Clayton on one corner, Ashbury on the other corner, where the Grateful Dead had their house. But when I moved there, it's between 65 and 66, it was all cheap. It was all, like, we had two thrift stores. The bus went right by on Haight for 35 cents. It would take you right downtown. Just a collection of all kinds of nationalities had stores there. Russian pierogi, Chinese restaurant, whatever you wanted, you could get it. You know, but people could live there, could afford to live there. It was just like maybe Greenwich Village was at one point. It was like a place where artists came and then plus, two blocks is Golden Gate Park, this amazing grassy area, and the Panhandle right there. I mean, it was meant to happen. You know, and so you'll hear it in Waller Street. It was like, too bad you're going all straight. It's like the rents now are $2,000 a month. You know, artists can't afford to live there. And, you know, so it's like we got to keep control of the neighborhoods, I think, a little bit. But when we wrote that song together, we were in love with each other. All the lyrics came out. You know, there was pot around. So, you know, got to have another toke. We owed bills. And the cops actually did make a raid and got the second floor and the floor. So, I mean, yeah, it's a true story. But it's certainly not true for us now. So the second half has, like, a little bit more, like, you know, come on, people. Let's remember that time.
Were you all living together in that house?
Not at that time.
No.
Okay.
But we're living together shortly after.
Shortly after.
We practiced there in the basement. Basement and upstairs with a piano, and we were able, that's where we wrote that song, right in the front bedroom of Waller Street. Right.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, sitting down. She sat on the floor then, too, Denise.
Denise, yeah. I should say we're sitting on the floor to talk right now. Love it. Well, take us to Waller Street then. Let's hear some Waller Street Blues.
To pay the rent, somebody roll up a smoke.
Pass those papers.
Bill collector at my door, and I know what he wants me for, but got to have another toke.
Exact paper.
You know, they took the water and left the pipes.
Left the switches, took the light.
The stove is still here, but it's broke. Sitting here by candlelight. Candles keep us warm at night.
We ain't got nothing to lose.
Pay your dues
now. You know, the cops, they made a raid next door. And then they got the bottom floor.
There's nobody left but us two.
Me and you now.
Astor Brown talking about the Water Street Blues. Oh yeah. Well, those lyrics are from 67. Now these lyrics are from 2019. You know, we got a little different take on things. Here we go.
Waller Street, oh Waller Street, what Waller Street, the sweetest street in the hate. Cole and Stanion are so fine, but Waller, she's a friend of mine. Too bad you're going off straight. Next to buses, next to stores, no, you couldn't ask for more. Come on, make it real love on hate. Come on, make it real love on hate. Come on, make it real love on hate.
Woo!
Come on, make it real love on hate.
Yeah, come on, girls, let's get together.
Woo. Come on, make it real love on hate.
There you go.
Remember 1968. Make it real.
You really give a lot away in that song. We know a lot about you.
I know the first version, the original version, some of the words we didn't sing now are like,
oh, like boy.
Remember, Diane, your verse? I bent down to pet the cat.
The cat, instead I found a furry rat, and now we're having rat tail stew.
Here's the backup line. Tasteless garbage. I mean, you know, it really works in today's world, doesn't it? You go out to the gas station, you go, what is this food? You know, so I just thought that back line was classic. Oh,
so you all meet each other and you start this band. And there were front women of bands at that time, right? Like
right.
Janis Joplin,
well, sure,
and
yeah.
Grace Slick of Jefferson Airplane, which is, I think, like really different. Like they were playing in bands with dudes,
right?
Which is a really different thing than what you're doing. Was there a difference between...
We'd never seen an all-women band.
Never.
You know, we had heard that there might be some, but we'd never, you know, we didn't ever... So we had no one to look to. It just came organically from our connection, and we were writing and we were playing and we liked what we were saying, and so it worked.
Yeah, and you can play the heck out of your instruments,
right?
So there you go. A few months after you made your debut, you opened for Jimi Hendrix, right?
Golden Gate Park.
So how did Jimi Hendrix find out who Ace of Cups were?
It really came through the management. Albert Grossman knew who we were because he was Janis's manager by then, and Jimmy's, and he was out of New York, but he knew our manager, Ron Pulte, so I think that's how it happened. It happened very quickly because the weekend before that, Jimmy had made his American debut at the Monterey Pop Festival, and it was the following weekend, and he wanted to do a free concert in San Francisco because he had heard about free concerts in the park.
Mm-hmm.
So he wanted to do one, and so our manager said, do you want to open up in the park this weekend for Jimi Hendrix on a flatbed truck? And we were like, yes!
For sure.
Oh, Denise, that's so good. Wait, so tell me what that was like. Like, walk me through what that day is. Like, you show up and there's a flatbed truck and there's Jimi Hendrix and
no, there,
what happened?
No. There was a flatbed truck and our equipment was on the stage. So Jimi Hendrix didn't bring anything, you know, but his guitar and his drumstick, you know, his drummer's drum. You know, they used our gear.
Oh, he just shows up with a guitar. Is he plugging into your amps and everything?
We opened, yeah. Right.
Just wow.
Like so. Our back line.
All the pictures of that day are Diane's drums, Mary's and my amps, Mary and Mary Gannon's amps. So that's what they played through.
Wild.
Yeah.
Was he nice? Did you guys talk to him?
Oh, he was fabulous. Yeah, Jimi Hendrix was actually, to my way of thinking, a very humble person. He was really beautiful. I mean, his spirit, you know, was a beautiful spirit. And it just kind of hit you, you know, when he talked. His voice, soft-spoken and just... Yeah, I don't know. It was something very special about him. And also his playing, of course, because I saw him the week before at the Monterey Pops Festival, and it changed my life.
Mm.
You know, just the way he played was just, I had never seen anything like it.
Would you pick a Hendrix song for us to play a bit of on the radio?
Let's see.
It's either Foxy Lady or...
Yeah, Foxy Lady's a good one. I like that.
Let's do it. That's some Jimi Hendrix, Foxy Lady. I'm talking to Ace of Cups here about their full-length debut album, and Mary Ellen, who plays lead guitar in this band, was just talking about the experience she had watching Jimi Hendrix.
So at that concert,
yeah, tell me.
He, when we played, he stood in, right in front of us and took photographs of us. And nobody else, basically, that we ever met took a photograph of us that day. Later, like not many years ago, we got a little like a brownie shot from somebody who said, "I think my dad was at that concert, and I think he has a picture of you." And that little teeny photograph from way back is on our in our album book, but there's no photograph of that day or any recording, which is kind of very sad.
Yeah. It all happened in real life. Like it's such a profoundly different experience than what we know now. If you're at
sure,
a Jimi Hendrix,
exactly.
You know,
yeah.
Everybody's
it's
taking
everywhere.
Pictures.
Yeah. And videos and streaming it. Yeah. Mary Ellen, I don't know if this is true, but I think it's probably true that Jimi Hendrix said that you were a really great guitarist.
That's what he said in an interview, I guess later, and showed up in Melody Maker, I think, in England. So, but he liked the whole band.
Yeah.
I mean, he really did. He really liked our band.
Tell me who taught you how to play guitar.
I learned from a woman named Naomi Healy, and that was mostly like folk music. You know, when I was 12, I started playing. And so I was learning, you know, the MTA and just the Coal Miner's Song, and just things like that. And then I fell in love with Joan Baez, and so I started learning a bunch of her numbers, and I played for the school. Like we had for the whole high school, I played for that, and in a talent show, and I was really scared and everything. But, anyway, I got a standing ovation, so I go, "Oh my God, this is wonderful!" You know, even though my hands were sweating and I was really scared, and then after that, when I moved to San Jose, I was going to San Jose State, and I went to a club that I later learned I think was owned by Paul Kantner, and up on the stage was this guy. Beautiful man playing this old blues type stuff. And it turned out to be Jorma Kalkanen, who later was in the Jefferson Airplane.
Oh, gee.
And I was a kind of a shy person, but I said, "I've got to go up and, you know, see if he can give me lessons." So I went up and asked him, and he said, "Sure." So he gave me a couple lessons, and it was really fabulous. You know, that's when I got into Jimmy Reed and all this kind of thing.
Jeez. Can you articulate like something that we hear in your guitar playing that you would have learned from Jorma, whether it's a, you know, like
any kind of blues that, you know, like Mom, I don't know about Mama's Love, but any kind of blues, there are certain riffs that are really used commonly, probably. You know, I've recently kind of fallen in love with the Stevie Ray Vaughan's type of blues playing, and I want to learn more and more about that.
Yeah.
Right now.
I think we hear that on Mama's Love, though, which you're going to do for us live here today. Tell me a little bit about writing the song Mama's Love and where it comes from.
That was an idea that I had that I thought there should be a song about Mama's love, you know, like how encompassing that type of love is. And once I brought it to Denise, you know, she came up with a lot of lyrics for this song. And we just, you know, kind of co-wrote it, but I'd say she wrote a good portion of that song.
Well, we'll hear it all at work here in Mama's Love. This is Ace of Cups performing live for us here at World Cafe.
This world, a defenseless child. I knew I would protect you like a lion in the wild. Oh yeah. this world, a defenseless child. I knew I would protect you like a lion in the wild. Oh yeah, like a lion in the wild. One thing you can count on, big as the sky above. One thing you can count on is your mama.
Live here at World Cafe, Mama's Love by Ace of Cups from their debut full-length album called Ace of Cups. You just heard Mary Ellen singing leads and playing lead guitar on that song. I'm here also with Denise, who plays bass. We got Diane on the drums. We got Mary G on uke and tambourine. And Denise, you mentioned a moment ago that you felt really passionate about what you were singing at that time. And I want to know, I guess, a little bit about what it actually meant to be a hippie during the summer of love in 1967, not just in terms of the music that I think we all think that we understand or feel nostalgic for, but like, what did it really mean to be part of that scene?
Well, I had just gotten basically, I'd been traveling with Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters on the bus for the year and a half before the Ace of Cups. Mm-hmm. And we'd been doing these events called the Acid Tests, where we had the band was the Grateful Dead, and we created these happenings and had Kool-Aid with LSD in it.
Wait, you're traveling around in a bus, mm-hmm, and transporting Kool-Aid with LSD to people at Grateful Dead shows.
Yeah, and there was sure also, no, it wasn't a Grateful Dead show, it was the Acid Tests, right.
Got it.
They were our band, but we were putting on these events to shift consciousness. Mm-hmm. That was the Kool-Aid. There was also what was called not the electric Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
There was regular Kool-Aid.
Cool.
Then there was the electric Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
So we made it clear so people had a choice. But with all of us, we had all had psychedelic experiences before we came together as a band. And those experiences opened our hearts and souls and spirits to a level of reality that pulsed with the oneness of all of this. And what was going on at that time in 1967 was that people everywhere were having that experience and seeing that some of the what we had been given to or been raised with as the way reality is, there was something deeper than that. That was connection of all of us. And I think that's what was the pulse of what was going on in the hate and everywhere. I mean, you listen to the Beatles music from that time. And when, you know, that music came out, everybody was like, right. It was like universal. I mean, nothing's happened like that. Like hardly on the planet where something grabbed the consciousness of particularly young people all over the world. And the sense that society could change, culture could change, that the way that we all related could change, and that we could be much more, we could work things out in a peaceful way and share with each other, and life was not about how much stuff you could gather. That was all present at that time. Mm.
If there's somebody listening now who's like, you know what, through the lens of today, drugs don't sound like the greatest way to get to that level of consciousness,
yeah, right.
What would you say to that person, I guess?
I would say meditation is
a
really good idea.
Yeah.
Meditation is a very good way. And I think a lot of people who actually used LSD ended up going to do meditation on a regular basis, and also yoga. You know, things that get you in tune with your spirit, and, you know, where you can kind of put a light on your own thinking and how it, you know, how is it coming out, and just everything, mm-hmm, you know, and about kindness. and the importance of motivation, you know, what are our motives for what we're doing and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
That comes out.
I mean, Denise was a protester from Berkeley. Besides what she said about Kesey and the bus, I mean, she...
I was arrested in the free speech movement at Berkeley when I went into Berkeley at 17, and when the free speech movement started, I was still 17, so they were the elders of the free speech movement were saying, you can't get arrested because you'll go to juvenile hall. But then I turned 18 in October, and the big arrests were right after that, so I ended up, you know, getting dragged out of Sproul Hall, you know.
What happened to you?
Well, there were 700 of us arrested.
Yeah.
And
can you imagine?
I was one of the last ones dragged out of Sproul Hall, and I ended up at Oakland City Prison, which was where most people got taken to Santa Rita, which was a little bit not quite as hairy of a place, but the last group of us they took to Oakland. It was pretty scary. I ended up with a torn up arm from being kicked by the police and everything. You know, the actual students feeling empowered and standing up to the administration of the university, which was really controlled by the Board of Regents, which were the people like William Noland, who a lot of those people were business people who had businesses in the South that were segregated. And they did not want the energy of the students in the North who'd been going south for the Freedom Summers the previous couple of summers. They did not want that coming north, and it was coming north. I mean, the whole civil rights movement was really powerful at that point, and they were trying to stop it. Hmm. They were just trying to, you know, you students should just go to class, you know,
Jeez.
Turn a blind eye.
What did your family or parents say when you're 18 and you're in
this? Got arrested?
Yeah.
I called them. They knew I was going to. And because I was in Sproul Hall, you know, there was, you know, no cell phones then, right? No, you know, but they lived in San Francisco, and my parents were kind, you know, in the kind of world of interesting people in San Francisco. And they happened to be at a dinner party with one of the judges who called the jail and said to let me out. But
she had connections.
Like on my own recognizance. But there were only a few of us, especially the women in the Oakland City jail. And there was, it was really very scary the way that we were being treated. And I just said, I'm not leaving without everybody. And there were probably about 12 of us. I said, you know, tell them we're sticking together. We're not leaving unless we leave together.
Wow.
So we eventually, in the morning, you know, all the great lawyers, the Berkeley lawyers came and got everybody, all 700 of us out of jail. And then, you know, a few days later, we all got, the charges were dismissed, you know. Mm. But I just want to say something to your question about drugs.
Yeah.
First of all, you can't put everything together like drugs.
There's all kinds
of really terrible things, and then there's some things that are sacred and used for, you know, really deepening humanity in rituals all over the planet. And so, you know, now because, you know, at the time when I first took LSD, it was not illegal. And then it became illegal. Didn't stop us, but all of those substances were made, I think, Schedule 1. So no research was allowed, no scientific research on any of that for a long time till really fairly recently. And now the kind of research that's being done with LSD, with mescaline, with some of these other substances is finding really amazing results for people, and everything from, you know, liberating them from alcohol or addiction to PTSD to depression. So, you know, I think that we're just like on the tip of the iceberg of what these plant medicines or derivatives of have to offer us.
Yeah. Thank you for saying that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's definitely a dark side also. Yeah. And that part started to show up in the Haight-Ashbury, actually. Amphetamine, that type of thing. It was heroin. Yeah. And then things started to change. And that's when we moved to Marin and, you know, kept playing music. And but, you know, I mean, thank goodness for rehab and, you know, people getting the tools that you need to change your life back to the better, you know, and maybe even grow way more, you know, than you might have. I mean, there's some awesome people in the recovery field.
Thank you, Mary.
Just totally awesome.
Yeah. Ace of Cups are here with me on World Cafe playing music from their debut full-length album. Okay, so before we move towards sort of the end of the Summer of Love, I have to ask you guys, the house that you were in together on Waller Street, you said was sort of down the road from the Grateful Dead house that we've all sort of seen pictures mm-hmm. of and all wish that we could have gone to and hung out at. Can you just indulge me and like tell me a story about, did you get to visit there? Were you hanging with?
I never did.
Yeah.
I knew where it was. I didn't go there.
I did one time in the very early days take Paul Simon there to meet the Grateful Dead.
How about you tell me that story, start to finish?
He had come, he and Art were playing at the Berklee Community Theater, and my sort of godfather, Ralph Gleason, they came over to Ralph's house. Ralph was a founding editor of Downbeat and also Rolling Stone and was just the great music writer and social observer, writer, critic at the San Francisco Chronicle at that time. And he happened to have all of Lenny Bruce's tapes. And Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel were Lenny Bruce fans. So they came over to Ralph's to hear the Lenny Bruce tapes. And Ralph had invited me over. And so subsequently, Paul came to San Francisco with me. And we went, played some, he sat in at a folk music club. And then, you know, I said, you want to, you know, go meet my friends? And they hate Ashbury. And he said, sure. And he really, you know, didn't know really who the Grateful Dead were. And I took him over there, and it was definitely a meeting of two worlds, you know what I mean? And, I think he didn't quite know what to make of that, like, you know, kind of communal situation, and Jerry downstairs on his guitar, and Bobby, and, you know, and like, and I was like, you know, anyway, it was definitely a funny moment.
I'm enjoying picturing that very much, very much. And you have Bob Weir on this album.
We do. We have Bob singing a song called The Well, which he was just so generous to come in and not only sang, but played
beautiful.
Beautiful guitar, like rhythm guitar, and then played lead too. And mm-hmm. I don't think there are very many instances of him playing leads, you know. But anyway, he was really wonderful, came in and sang that song, and we had a really good time working on the backups, and we love the song. Drinking from the well where the water runs deep.
Mm. What's that about?
That place we were just talking about, okay. You know, yeah. It's yeah. Like I can see by the look in your eyes, you've been drinking from the well where the water runs deep. And recognizing that when you see that in another being, you know, mm-hmm. the way you can just recognize it. And then the lyric of that song is also about maybe someone who is trying to make it more alone and then feels more connected now. Hmm. Yeah.
Let's play it.
Sink your roofs into the ground. Feel the shimmer in the ties that bind. Time to take it easy and unwind. Time to take it easy. I can tell by the look in your eyes you've been drinking from the well.
That's The Well, Ace of Cups, featuring Bob Weir. I'm here with the whole band. We're going to hear you play one more song for us. It's Grandma's Hands. It's a Bill Withers cover. Mm-hmm. And I guess in the spirit of that song and singing about Grandma's Hands, it's very rare that we shine a spotlight on women who are grandmothers, I think.
That's right.
Three of you are, mm-hmm. I think.
Right. Yeah.
And women who are in their 70s and look at them as stars.
Thank you.
And we should do, because if anything, the stories and the experience and the depth, I mean,
thank you,
is beautiful. So can you just maybe speak to how that feels or what that means, or whether that's something that I don't even mean to, like, it feels like an even ageist question to ask, but yes.
So I'd like to say that in the early days, whatever we were breaking through on, just being an all-female band, and we were all, and I was like 19 to 23 years old when we started. That was, you know, an anomaly at the time. Now we get the chance to kind of raise the flag for women much later in life. You know, we're all in our 70s, and there's clearly a societal bias so that, you know, men can star in films up till whatever age they do, and women have to retire much earlier in this current world. And so I think that a society that doesn't really get off on its elders has a big mistaken notion about living.
You're just missing out.
Yes, yeah. You know, totally.
Yeah.
The thing that's great for us is that we hear from so many women of all ages who just say they're inspired by what we're up to, and that just that what we do gives them something, and that's what we really want. Just to encourage everybody, but particularly women, because it's harder for women in some of these arenas, to just, you know, go for it. Do not stop. Do not give up.
Stay healthy.
Stay healthy.
Best you can.
Yes. Mm-hmm. You know, stay together with the people you love.
That's right.
You know?
And support one another. Like the way that you each at some point during this interview have wanted to give credit to somebody else for something that they didn't say about themselves is like knocking me out. But that's what it is. Yeah. And it's really beautiful. So thank you. Let's hear Grandma's Hands. Yeah.
Okay.
Queen used to hand me piece of candy. Grandma's hands picked me up each time I fell. Grandma's hands, boy, they really came in handy. He'd say, baby, don't whip that child. What you wanna spank her for? She done dropped no apple core, but I don't have grandma anymore. If I get to heaven, I'll look for grandma's hand.
Ace of Cups performing Grandma's Hands. That's a Bill Withers cover. It is on their full-length debut album. Mary G., Diane, Denise, and Mary Ellen, thank you. And also we have to shout out Giovanna, who's your special guest and playing keys for you.
Giovanna and Basie are dear friend and amazing, amazing musician. Yes. We're so honored to be touring with her right now.
A wonderful spirit.
Yeah.
Cool. Thank you so much to all of you, and congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you, Denise, Mary Ellen, Mary Gannon, Diane, and Giovanna playing keys with Ace of Cups. Go check out their whole full-length studio debut album, and stay tuned because I think these women are just getting started. Thanks to our World Cafe producer, John Myers, for making that happen, and Chris Williams, our amazing engineer, for recording that session. Thanks also to Rachel on Team Ace of Cups. I'm Talia Schlinger, and you are listening to the World Cafe from NPR.